There's a very famous book about handling sibling rivalry, and I'm going to be a little chutzpah because I really disagree with the very premise of the book. But some of you may have heard of the book called Siblings Without Rivalry, right? And it's a very nice book, and it has some very good points. I'm not knocking the book, but I'm going to challenge the title. And the point of what I'm going to try to teach you today, or I'm going to try to convey over to you today, is that that's not the goal. The goal is not to have siblings without rivalry. In fact, I think that's next to impossible. For one thing, I'm going to share with you a finding of a study that when I say this, everybody just wipes their brow and breaks into a smile. So get ready. Studies show that normal families have sibling rivalry. And that it's a sign of a normal family if you have sibling rivalry. It's in abnormal families, it's in problematic families where you don't have sibling rivalry. So if there's your kids are fighting, and if there's tension between your siblings, that's a sign that you have a normal family. And hopefully by the time I'm done with my piece, that'll make sense to you. Because my goal today is not to tell you how to stop sibling rivalry. It's natural. It's normal. Most sibling rivalry. I'll give you some examples of some abnormal sibling rivalry. Those of you who know my family can use that as a model. But if of normal sibling rivalry, to show you what function and what purpose it serves. That it's good to have sibling rivalry. It's one of the many ways in which children are learning about life, and that the challenge is not to get rid of sibling rivalry, but to use it, to exploit it, to manage it in such a way that it becomes something useful. Now, let me start by asking you a question. I'm going to sort of ask it in a double negative, so pay attention, okay? And I'm going to ask you how many of you can say, first of all, are there any only children here? Okay, so I'll talk about that in a minute, okay? So you're excluded, okay? But those of you who grew up with siblings, or I would also exclude someone who's like a Ben Zakunim or whatever, that where there was like a huge schism between them and their siblings in terms of age. But how many of you that grew up in the normal circumstances where you had siblings close to age could say that you, whom you are today, was not impacted upon or was not affected by your relationship with your siblings? Was not impacted upon. Which means that the vast majority, you're not sure, okay, but the vast majority of you would say that in actuality, your relationships with your siblings growing up shaped you for who you are today. Okay, would you say so? Okay. I know I asked the question in double negative. Not abuse, negative. No. You're shaped. In other words, who you are. Positive. Obviously, it's mostly positive. Most of us are doing pretty good. You know, I don't think we let out any members of the psychiatric facilities or prisons to come here, right? I mean, I know that Frank was anxious to have a large turnout, so maybe he did arrange for the local Passaic prison to free a few guys and people to come out here. But assuming we're all normal, well-functioning people, and we all have pretty normal, fulfilling relationships, so we're all pretty healthy people, but how we became who we are. Like, for example, if I asked you about your parents, you'd all say, of course my parents shaped me, you know, and your community, of course your community shaped me. But you're also telling me that your siblings and your relationship with your siblings, growing up and to this day even, have shaped you and made you whom you are. And the reality is, and an interesting thing, that this is probably the most neglected area in terms of understanding psychological development or how we become whom we are. That we don't really focus on sibling relationships. And they're very important. In fact, I know there's one person who's aware of this. One other area of my life which I'm involved, which is something, God willing, none of you should ever need, is I work in the area of what's called parental grief. I mean, for lack of a better term, families who've lost children. And sometimes I emphasize that in the English language, there's no word for such people. I mean, there's a word for people who lose parents, lo aleinu, which is orphans, lose a spouse, a widow, but there's no word for a parent who loses a child. In Hebrew, there is, in av shakul, em shakula. But in Hebrew, English, in no language that I've ever found, there is a word for someone who, again, Rahman al-Aslan loses a sibling. And yet it's a loss. There's avelus. You know, I remember one Rav telling me that he visited a family, someone sitting shiva for a parent who was a Holocaust survivor. And while he was sitting there, he said to the Rav, you know, my father had children before the war. And he said, I didn't have children before the war. Those were your brothers and sisters. And he said, I never even thought of them that way. You know, it was like so removing, and that has something to do with the Holocaust. But again, these are real relationships, and these are important relationships. And yet we don't pay attention to them. And so the relationship you have with your siblings, which at varying points, especially if they're siblings close to age, can be a rivalrous one, are important ones and are shaped whom you are and are shaping who your children are. And basically what it does is your relationship with your parents, and to some extent with your teachers, shapes your attitude towards hierarchical relationships, relationships with authority. So today, the fact that you're able to relate to a boss, that you're able to relate to a rabbi, if he's an authority in your community, that you're able to relate to a Kadosh Baruch Hu, was shaped to a large extent by your relationship with people who were in a dominating or in a superior position vis-a-vis you. In other words, your parents, your teachers, etc. Your relationships with your contemporaries, the parallel relationships that you have, your relationship with your friends, with your co-workers, was shaped partially by your classmates and your friends, but partially by your relationship with your siblings. Because that's the laboratory. That's the area where you experimented and you learned about relating to those with whom you have, like, as I said, a parallel relationship. Those who are your, you know, friends or your co-workers or your neighbors, etc., was shaped by your relationship, A, with your friends, but also with your siblings. By the way, the question that you're probably asking and another person, what about us only children? So you have other arenas where you've learned it. The human psyche is very adaptable. Just like, you know, someone, again, God forbid, who doesn't have a parent, learns how to relate to an authority by relating to other adults. So your laboratory was more your classmates, your friends, your cousins, etc. So it's not like you've been deprived, but if you have siblings, it's very convenient, you know, because you can experiment with it right at home. So I'm going to propose to you that there are basically two lessons in life that kids learn from their relationship with their siblings, which creates rivalry, and when we understand what lesson they're learning, what function it serves, then we'll know how to handle it. And basically the two lessons are conflict resolution / sharing. In other words, how do you learn, with your spouse for that matter, how did you learn to resolve differences and conflicts? How do you learn to resolve differences and conflicts with neighbors, with co-workers, etc.? How did you learn to share? I mean, again, we take some of these things so for granted, we don't realize that we weren't born knowing this, all right? That you have to, you know, that if you share a driveway, if this were Brooklyn, this would be relevant, but, you know, if you're sharing a driveway with your neighbor, which is big enough to fit in, a Toyota Corolla, and you both have vans, of course, you know, how do you share that little space, and how do you manage, and how do you work that out? Or if you, how would work? Do you work out, you know, the system with paying for the coffee and, those who participate, those who don't participate, all these things? Or how do you know about how taking out neighbor friends and the friends take you out? All these things we do that we share. Or how do you know how to work out your differences with these people? You learn that from beating up your brother and sister. That's how you learned it, from working out your differences with your siblings. That's one area. And the other issue that you learned, I'm going to go into this some more, is you've also learned the bitter pill that life is not fair, that things are not equal. Some people, you know, there's a classic story, and it really touches upon this. They tell a story about the stipler, that someone once came to the stipler and said, you know, I have this business and I'm making $15,000, but the guy across the street is making $25,000. And the stipler said, don't worry, it'll get better. So they came back a few months later and said, okay, you know, I'm making $30,000. The guy across the street is making $60,000. He said, don't worry, it'll get better. Comes back a few months later and says, okay, I'm making $50,000. But the guy across the street is making $150,000. Why is he making so much more money than I am? And Stiple said, very, very simple reason. He's running one business, you're running two businesses. His and yours, you know? So, you know, the fact that you learn that life isn't always fair, that things don't always work out evenly, that someone down the block has more money than you do and does the same thing, that the neighbor across the street is driving a nicer car, that your cousin has so much more nachas than you do, that there are these inequities. I mean, obviously upstairs everything is equal and fair, but you know, in our world life is not fair. The fact that we can tolerate that, the fact that we are able to cope with that, the fact that we accept that as part of life, we develop from our fighting and our tension with our siblings. Because what's the clarion call of every kid? It's not fair. They're getting used to this idea, because that's a whole new concept. Again, we take these things for granted because we had siblings to experiment with and we learned this. But the kids that don't necessarily have that. So okay, so let's now take each thing and show how we can use this to, again, use sibling rivalry, not have siblings without rivalry, but to have siblings with rivalry and let them learn through the rivalry these important life messages, okay? You're following me so far? With me? Okay, great. It's very early in the morning, and I've only had two sips of coffee, so give me a second. Okay. So, the first lesson, conflict resolution, sharing. Okay? Again, the kids have differences. They argue. What do we want to teach them? We want to teach them how to work it out. So the job of the parent is not to necessarily, first of all, do not, and here's a rule of thumb, do not try to figure out who started. If there is an example in this world of spontaneous combustion, if there's an example in this world of yesh me'ayin, if the Big Bang Theory has any validity, it's with sibling rivalry. You will never figure out who started. It is so subtle. He looked at me, he smelled at me, he talked at me, he breathed too fast, the young thing. And you're going to sit there trying to figure out, you're going to apply to be King Solomon, you're going to be cutting a lot of babies in half, because you'll never figure it out, okay? So it's, again, normal sibling rivalry. It's as I said, they just get within about a 30-mile radius of each other, and they're ready, you know, and it's going to happen. Okay? So what happens then when there is this conflict? Let's say they're fighting over something, very typical kind of thing. They're fighting over a toy. They're fighting over computer time. They're fighting over who gets to use the trampoline or something like that. You're going to try to figure out who started, who's right. You're going to try to work out some sort of solution. It'll never work. And besides that, and here's the key point. If you do it, then you're depriving them of the opportunity of learning how to do this themselves, which is what you want them to do. You want them to learn how to work out their differences. So that the goal, the ideal goal, is to put the onus of responsibility on them to resolve their differences. Okay? So if they're fighting over the computer, there's no computer until you figure out how to share it. Well, I used to say to my kids when they were younger, you know, you got lots of toys and I have no toys. This toy is my toy until you can share it. You'll be surprised how quickly they work out some sort of compromise. Right? Because again, you're not taking sides. This way, you're not showing any favoritism. You're not engaging in that insurmountable task of trying to figure out who started. Right? You're just taking, it's up to you. And I don't want any piece of it. I don't want to be involved. Okay? Work it out yourselves. Or even if they're fighting. And by the way, I want to tell you a scientific fact that I have not yet proven, but I hold it to be true, and I'm waiting someday to prove it. Car manufacturers put something in the ventilation system of their cars that make kids fight. They get into that car, and you haven't even pulled out of the driveway yet. And, of course, you're driving to Orlando, you know? And they're already at each other's, first, are we there yet? You know, and you're still on Passaic Avenue. And then they start fighting, okay? And I'm telling you, it's something, and of course, you want to avoid these fights. So you buy a 20-seat van for your three kids, you know, with barriers and alarms, and they somehow find each other and they start fighting. That doesn't make a difference. You can buy the biggest van in the world. There's some, they get into a car, they fight, okay? I used to have a policy. You can develop your own. When the kids would start fighting, I'd pull the car over and I'd say, we'll continue when you stop. Now, this was a problem on the George Washington Bridge. I admit it. You know, you might have, again, my kids are old now, but back then you would have heard traffic reports. There's a tie-up on the George Washington Bridge. The Blumenthal kids are fighting again. You know, I understand that that was a problem. But again, I put the onus of responsibility. You guys work it out. I create a situation where you have to figure out how to get along. I'm not going to take sides. I'm not going to figure it out for you. You figure. And by the way, it used to work like a jet. I used to understand. As far as it was very interesting, I used to understand when we were going to the amusement park, why that would upset them. But when we were coming home into a school the next day, why that bothered them, I don't know. But it did. If I started pulling over to the shoulder of the road, we'll figure it out. We'll do something. You know, it was an amazing thing. But again, I'm putting the responsibility on them to figure it out, to work it out. And, God willing, someday, when they have a conflict with a spouse, when they have a conflict with a coworker, when they have a conflict with a neighbor, now they're developing skills to resolve these conflicts. That's why it's a beautiful thing. That's why I want rivalry. That's why I want that. And that's why they do it. That's why it's so universal, because they're learning. They're learning skills. It's no different than learning math or learning how to eat with a fork. If somebody teach me how to eat with a fork sometime. No, but it's no different. They're learning a very important life skill. And anything you learn yourself, and any skill you develop yourself, is much more meaningful to you. Now, there could be situations, and by the way, if it gets out of hand, before I get to the situation, if it does, you know, if you know, limbs are severed or something like that, you know, where you're at that point, you know, then if you have to punish, Or if you have to intervene, you intervene on both. Sometimes as a mucker, I bring the famous Rashi in Vayomer Moshe LaRasha, right? Moshe broke up a fight, you know, saw the two Jews fighting, and he spoke to the Rasha, to the wicked one. Of course, Rashi asks, how do you know who's a Rasha? And one of the answers is, you're fighting, you're Rasha. That's it. If you get into a fight, you're a bad person. That's it. And that's the attitude that you can take. You can say, okay, you two are fighting. I don't want to know. Again, it's Yeshman, you're never going to figure it out. If you have to intervene, it's getting out of hand. If it's really, you know, if let's say they're hitting each other or something like that, you both go to your room. You both lost dessert tonight. You both can't go to this and this special treat. Now that accomplishes two things. First of all, you're not taking sides. Second of all, again, you're communicating to them that you're putting the onus of responsibility back on them to resolve their differences. And more importantly, what's the only thing that unites people? Come on.
Common enemy.
Now you're the enemy, and you're supposed to be the enemy. You know, now they hate you more than they hate each other. You know, which is fine. That's what's supposed to happen, you know? You know, my mother says that in Europe, she said, I have a grandson here in Passaic, so I can, that in Europe, they used to call grandchildren Sinem from the Sinem. You know, the enemies of the enemy. Even my grandparents and grandchildren, God said, well, got along so well, they have a mutual enemy, you know? And she used to call my kids Sinem from the Sinem, you know? So this is it. So that's what unites people. So if you're gonna, once you become the bad guy, and you punish both of them, now they're getting along because they hate you more than they hate each other. So again, you put it as much as possible, you put it back on them. Now, let's say in those instances where they can't. Okay, again, the simplest example, there's a certain amount of computer time, they're fighting over the computer, you say the computer's shut down, you pull out the plug, you wrap it up, you put it in the bedroom, you say you can have a computer back when you work at it, and it can't. This one comes crying, and this one comes crying, and this one, you know, and each one's coming now with an attorney, and you know, and it's escalating out of hand. Okay, you can then intervene, but the intervention should be one to teach them how to work it out, not to work it out for them. To sit down, or if you're working it out for them, then the spirit of your working it out for them should be to teach them how to do it. As if you say, I have a suggestion. There's 2 hours of the computer. Why don't we do 1 hour? You get the first hour, you get the second hour. We alternate every week or every day. We alternate or something like that. And you propose that to them. And let's say, then you show them, you see, sometimes when you can't agree, each of you have to give up something. You have to share, you have to work that. Maybe next time you can figure out a solution. Or next time when instead of the computer, if they're fighting over the trampoline outside or something like that. Remember what we did with the computer? Let's see if you can do that with the trampoline. Again, even if you have to intervene, and again, you're not trying to figure out who's right, and you're not trying to take sides, and you can say that, I don't know, I don't really know, etc., etc., but I'm trying to teach you and convey and give over to you ways to resolve differences. And that's the rule of thumb with all childbearing. Whenever you have a child, whenever you have a situation, you fast forward to adulthood, you figure out the analogous situation as adults, and what skills would you want them to have? And the same thing here. If there is an issue of conflict, what skills would you want them to have in the future so they can work out conflicts? So as I said, if you have to intervene, and sometimes you have to, sometimes the kids don't have those skills developed yet, then you intervene in the spirit of teaching, not to be King Solomon and not to work out the differences. Okay, now the other thing, that's lesson number one, conflict resolution. As I said, lesson number two, that the children are learning from being in situations of sibling rivalry is that life is not fair. And life is not fair. There are seeming inequities, and we tolerate that, and we handle it. And the same thing is true with the children. The children, when they come complaining, are getting used to this idea that there isn't, at least from our vantage point, perfect justice in this world. People have different skills, different talent, different money, different natural attributes, etc. So how they cope with that? And again, that we teach them from sibling rivalry, and we teach them to be solvable, that to absorb that, which means that you can't and you shouldn't be 100% fair. Sometimes parents are so frantic to get rid of sibling rivalry that they engage in frenetic efforts to try to make everything, to portion out everything perfectly equal. I remember as a kid, my father used to say that he would have to count the bubbles in the Pepsi Cola, because every time he pours, this one gets more and this one gets less, and he can't portion it out equally. And if you really, really, let's say you are incredibly methodical and you are incredibly organized and you're capable of giving every single kid exactly the same goodies in life that you portion out equally, you're doing your child a disservice. Because that's not life. And the kids are going to expect that when they get out there in the world, and that's not how things are. There are inequities in life. And I'm not saying you should purposely show a tremendous amount of favoritism for one child over the other or anything like that to make them swallow the pill, but in the normal course of events, normal course of development, there will be these inequities, and they have to some extent cope with it. So they should, first of all, there's nothing wrong with their complaining. You want them to complain. If you're doing your job right, your kid about 48 times a day is coming and saying, "Is that fair?" You know, that's because they're learning this. They're getting used to this idea. And you can't be, to some extent, obviously you have to be fair in the fact of trying to give everybody the same as much as you can. Or what they, it's not, being fair means not giving them the same. Giving the fair means giving them each one what they want. I mean, a typical example, right? You know, your 9-year-old gets 2 pancakes and your 6-year-old gets 1 because that's all they can eat. Now, of course, the trick is you take the 1 pancake and you cut it in half and suddenly the 6-year-old's a little old for that, but you can pull that off with a 4-year-old, you know? And then, oh, I got 2 and you got 2. But sometimes, you know, older children go to sleep later. Okay? When a kid has a birthday, I mean, I know parents, when their 6-year-old has a birthday, they got to make sure the 4-year-old gets just as many presents. Doesn't work like that. Yes, give him a little something, because it is hard for the 4-year-old to see that. But yes, the 6-year-old is going to get more on his birthday, and the 4-year-old will get more on his birthday. That's life. I'll tell you something that I used to do, but, you know, could be that's why I spent so much time, money on my kids' therapy, but sometimes when my kids would complain, come to me and say, "Well, you gave him more soda," I just looked at them and said, "I love him more." Now, they knew not to take me too seriously, fortunately, so that worked. But, again, a lot of people don't like that. But the main point is, again, we give each kid what they need, you know, basher husham, what they need at that time. There will be inequities. And there will be time, or sometimes they'd come to me, you know, "It's not fair, the cones let their kids go to sleep at 10 o'clock, and we have to go to sleep at 9 o'clock. And I say, "Well, you have to understand the difference between the cones and the Blumenthal. The cones love their children." But you know something, because I said, maybe that's, I'm maybe a little sarcastic, and maybe that doesn't suit you. But it, the message to them was, yeah, that's the way it is, you know. It's if you know, I'm not going to get upset about it. I'm not going to worry. I'm not going to engage in these kind of frenetic activities to make everything even. It's good that they see that. It's good that they experience that. That's how they tolerate these basic realities of life. Let me mention a few now. That's the normal sibling rivalry. That's what hopefully most of you are coping with or dealing with. Let me mention a few situations that are either abnormal or some of the kind of common questions that I get asked. First of all, sometimes people ask me about sharing rooms, not sharing rooms. There's nothing wrong with kids sharing rooms. One of my best friends when I was growing up lived in a 2-bedroom apartment, and he and his 2 brothers shared one room, and they're perfectly normal. It's becoming less and less the norm as God, you know, thank God we're so becoming wealthier and can afford more. So we have this luxury sometimes of giving each child their own room. But there's nothing wrong with kids sharing room, although there should be a concept, and again, fast forward to adulthood, there should be a concept of ownership. There should be a concept of a certain area, if you will, or a closet, a cupboard that is theirs and which they have bylaws over, which they have the right to say what's done with them, what's not done with them. Same thing, by the way, with toys and items, that there is such a thing as owning something. Again, what do I want to do? I want to fast forward to adulthood. And let's say, again, you have one of those houses where you share a driveway. You're granted the driveway, or you share other things, which happens sometimes with neighbors. And, yeah, those you have to learn how to share. But your actual house itself, nobody has a right to come in and, you know, just take your food. You know, there's things you own you can say yes, you can say no to, and things you share. And to teach them this whole idea, it's important, again, once the child has that concept. I mean, the age of, you know, the toddler or the very young child doesn't even have a concept of ownership. You know, sometimes hard for older siblings, so they just grab everything. And they don't know. They don't understand. But once they reach that age where they understand the idea, this is mine and this is yours and I can give and I cannot, we encourage, you try to teach, yes, it is yours. And yes, you have a say. And if you say no, that's okay. It's very nice if you share. Or then you can say no, but don't be upset if next time the other one says no. So again, we're teaching them this idea of sharing, etc. But whether they have collective toys, separate, there should be some mixture. These toys belong to the whole family. Everybody shares them. Again, then they learn about sharing, they learn that's the reality of life, that the things we share, the street, we share, you know, the sidewalk. On the other hand, there's some things that are just yours, and you can decide whether you share them or not, and someone has to take care of them or give them back to you. So you can load the deck, if you will, in that direction. There's seats up front. That's the price you pay for coming late. You have to sit near the teacher, and you get called on at the end when I ask questions. Seriously, I really don't mind. Please come up. So you can structure things that way. It's not, nobody is irreparably damaged by having to share a room or share certain toys, etc. And please don't put yourself in debt. I mean, maybe it's another talk, but please don't put yourself in an irreversible situation because every one of your 13 children have to have their own room. Okay, be careful about what my mother used to call the gitanar, which is in Yiddish means the good fool. What do I mean? The other way around, the professional victim. What can happen, again, is, and usually it's oldest girls, okay, but the kid who gives in to everything. So again, as I said earlier, you want to teach the children conflict resolution. You want to teach the children sharing, okay? So you have your oldest daughter, who's usually named Shandel or Tova, or one of these kind of names that already sort of shapes them as this, you know, sucker, you know? And, you know, And they're always giving in, and then they don't want to get into a fight. So when you pass the buck back to them, and you say, okay, you work it all right, you can have everything, right? Or again, the kid who's always, if a kid's being ganged up on, and always sort of finds themselves at the you know in the lower end of the stick, you have to be careful about that. So let's say again, we'll go back to the example we gave before. It's sharing the computer. They're fighting over the computer. You give it back to the kids. And then you realize that Shandel and Tova are always giving up the computer and not fighting for their own. Then you can say, that's not an acceptable solution for me. You know, that I don't know. That's not, I don't accept that, because that's not how you share. That's not how you compromise. So you want to be careful, again, even if when you give it back to the kids, or for that matter, the other kid always has to have his way or her way. How do I say his? Interesting, okay? You know, his name, you know, and his name's usually Arye or something strong or, you know, and he has to have his way, and he's always getting his way because he screams and makes such a racket or is so, you know, or starts punching right away, everybody gives in to him. So if you see those kind of very polarized, those kind of very extreme behaviors emerging, then you intervene. You say, no, that's not an acceptable solution. Not unlike court, by the way. If you know that sometimes in a court, if there's a dispute, you know, the parties try to work out different. They can work out a compromise, but the judge may have to decide whether they accept the compromise. You're the judge, and you can decide whether the compromise is acceptable. Also, by the way, most normal sibling rivalry, the kind of normal, desirable sibling rivalry that I'm talking about, takes place between kids close in age and usually the same gender, especially in our circles where we separate the genders more than in other circles. But cross-gender isn't that atypical, especially with the younger children. As their lives get more separated and the social lives get more separated, then it may be more important. But usually, as I said, it's kids close in age and usually have whose lives overlap with one another a lot more, so there's a lot more of this normal kind of conflicts and differences. Your 14-year-old should not have sibling rivalry with your 4-year-old. And if that's going on, that's not normal or typical sibling rivalry. That should be more of some concern to you. And also, by the way, normal sibling rivalry is not, it feels incessant to you, but it's not incessant. It feels incessant to you because, like, anything negative feels like it's constantly happening. But the more typical sibling rivalry is that sort of love-hate relationship, you know, where they're getting along great and then they want to kill each other. And, you know, there's that back and forth. So, but if it is really incessant, and if it's really the hallmark of their relationship with little else, then you're talking about something that's already perhaps outside the norm. Okay, and also you have to be careful about the bullying or the ganging up. You can have that. That's also something, again, where you may have to intervene. The ganging up may occur, again, a lot of it has to do with temperament of the child or the gender, etc. But let's say a docile, easygoing kid positioned right between two more aggressive kids and is always getting the short end of the stick, then that's something that, again, is not the normal or not the typical thing. And if you see then, and what can happen then is, as I said, the person can become the professional victim, can become one of these people who's always giving in and not standing up for what they should stand up, then again, that might involve, then you may have to get involved then and intervene. And sometimes the most effective way to do that is not to try to give this kid a chance of taking on those two very aggressive siblings, because it's very hard, but maybe steer the kid more towards playmates, towards peers, or away from that situation, because that can develop then into his personality. There are times when sibling rivalry is not this type of laboratory or experimenting with life that I described, but where it is a distraction. That was from the earlier theories. These were the early theories of sibling rivalry, was that it's to distract parents from other things, meaning that, and I'll give you a very simple example, okay? It's Friday afternoon, your kids are coming home from school, right? And of course, first Tova Shenda comes home, and she, of course, is Talmida of the month, and she goes, Mommy, I'm Talmida of the month. Oh, it's wonderful, mwah, mwah, mwah. You hang it on the refrigerator, right? And then the next kid comes in who's also great. Mommy, I got 100 my signs. Oh, I'm so proud. Mwah, mwah, mwah. We'll call Bubby later, and you hang it on the refrigerator. Then your third kid comes, right? Mommy, the principal wants to call you. I got into a fight. I beat up Dovey, and I broke his window, and he said, oh, he thinks maybe I should go to a different school. Suddenly you drop the children, drop out. What? What are you talking about? Oh, my God. Sit him down, call the father. Right? What's that psychologist's name? A number again, and suddenly you're completely distracted. It's a mitzvah, and kids know this, that negative behavior distracts parents or draws attention to them much more than positive behavior. It just happens to be the reality. It's a psychological reality in general, which explains a lot of things, that negative behaviors are more potent and more powerful than positive ones. So if there is something going on at home, and something can be any number of things, it can be a marital problems, it can be financial problems, it can be illness, it can be any number of the nisyonos that are visited upon us, it's not uncommon that kids will engage in negative behaviors to distract the parents from their tzaras, or to bring the attention back upon themselves. So if there is some of this more strident more atypical kind of sibling rivalry going on, you may have to consider the possibility that the point of it is to distract the parents from whatever else is going on, as I said, and to draw attention to themselves. One or two more quick points, and I want to leave some time, because I do want to have time for some give and take, okay? You can't demand love. Okay, so please don't go. Please don't worry. I'm not. I'm used to this. I have kids. You can't insist that someone loves someone else. Love is a feeling, and one surefire way. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I hear, and I'm sure many of you would concur with this. You can think of when you were a kid, how you fought tooth and nail with your brother and your sister, and now you're like almost, you're so close, and you love each other dearly. I mean, that's normal, because again, the fighting that took place when you were kids was all this that we were talking about. You were just trying to figure out life. It wasn't a personal fight. You were using your brother and sister to learn these lessons. So now that you know them, you don't have to fight with the brother and sister, and you can love them. But many of these, very rivalrous relations turn out to be very loving and caring ones. But one way you can guarantee it won't is if you start insisting that the kid love the sibling. They don't have to love their sibling. They have to treat them decently. They have to stop, breaking their nose, because the orthopedic bills are very expensive. You can demand certain behavior. You can demand certain restraint. How they feel, and I'm saying you shouldn't demand it. You can say it'd be lovely if you did. You can talk about how, if you want, you can talk about how great, how blessed you feel because you have such a wonderful relationship with your sibling, even though the person happens to live in Australia, you've never seen them because, whatever, but, you can do things like that, but to tell a kid to love a sibling is almost a guarantee that they won't, because you're almost demanding something from them that has to be spontaneous. And, again, how you feel about it, it's up to you. If a kid expresses emotion, I hate him, and some parents feel that the word hate shouldn't be in their mouth. If that's your standard, it's fine. I mean, every family is entitled to have their own standards. But the fact that they feel that way at that moment, or they use that word, doesn't mean that they actually are going to, for the rest of their lives, hate this person. Whatever you feel, but you can't do this or that, or you can't, okay, that's how you feel now. Maybe you'll feel differently later. I, for one, never fazed me much when a kid would say either to a parent or to a sibling, I hate you. They're using that word very loosely. They're not using the word in the sense that we mean it. But again, you can't dictate a feeling. If you don't want the kid to use the word hate, then you tell him, you mean you're very angry at him. And then the kid, will come back and say, no, I hate him. But but you can try that. Now, you have to, one more thing, and then with that I'll conclude. There is sometimes, and I know we all love our children differently, and equally, if you will. I mean, there's no such thing as, you know, we really do, you know, there's certain things in life that are not quantitative. You know, we think it is, you know, but you know, love is not one of those things. You have love. You can love one person, two people, 100 people. It doesn't run out, you know. It's like aser taser. You know, when you give tzedakah, you have more. It's the Talmud has that often. Vayom shmo tishmu. When you listen, you hear more. There's some things that are not bound by the laws of physics. But there are times when you connect better with some child than the other, or there are times when you need to give more attention to another child. Again, life's not fair. If you have a kid who's going through a difficult phase, if you have a kid who may have, has a learning disability and needs more attention and needs more tuning, so a kid will sometimes have to get more attention, or sometimes it happens that a kid is just a kind of, either a kid's just like a real easygoing, loving kid and they're very easy to connect with, or again, what might be more typical is, you know, there's two sets of DNA that the kid has. And, you know, there's a good one from the mother and the bad one from the father. You know, that's basic biology, you know. And I know where the numbers are here, you know, but... And you'll have a kid who just connect with better. It just naturally. So you have to be... And sometimes all you need to do... And that's mitzvah. It's a reality. Again, let's take a situation. A kid's going through a difficult phase and you really have to spend more time with them. Kid's struggling in school. So you have to sit for much more time with that kid doing homework. Then it... You don't have to try to... Now, it doesn't mean now you have to, like, try to give equal amount of time to the kid who doesn't need it. You know, I have a very cute cartoon that I sometimes use when I use PowerPoints. It shows a kid by a computer and the father standing there with a baseball glove and ball, and the kid says to the father, quality time? Do I have to? You know, it's not like you have to impose on the kid things that the kid doesn't want, but acknowledge it. Speak about it. Pull the kid aside, especially if they're older, and say, you know, I'm spending a lot of time with so-and-so, you know, having a hard time in school. It's not that I love him more. People need things different times. If you ever need me, you'll get the same thing. Sometimes all you need, the kids know it. But sometimes if you just give it a name, because sometimes you find kids, I mean, you'll hear later on about a kid who resented a sibling, let's say he was sick, because the kid got so much attention, nobody wants to be sick, but they would almost develop a hypochondria because, oh, that's how you get attention, by being sick. But if you acknowledge it, if you state it, and if you give, make sure that there is some time, not equal time, but there is time. Let's say, if again, you have a family situation where one kid does need a disproportionate amount of your time and attention. If the others get at least, it can be small amounts of time, but get something which is their own time so they know that this is not a personal kind of thing, usually you can resolve that pretty easily. Okay, we have about 10 minutes for questions, and go ahead, yeah.
So let's say that you have a Shandel Tova or whatever.
Right, yeah. Everybody has a Shandel Tova, yeah.
Very close in age, you also have an REA.
Yes.
And who's the instigator of most things and will admit that he's, like, they have a fight, the Shandel Tova.
Can I interrupt you now?
Sure.
Be very careful about the kid, even if they admitted that they're the instigator. Because very often, the non-instigator is just very good at doing it subtly. Like, he hit me! You know, I just had to lick my lip, you know. They're very good. Okay, but let's say you're right. Let's say, you know, you have a camera, you've examined their behavior. Okay, go ahead, yeah.
You've
okay.
even witnessed it.
Okay.
And they're not afraid to tell you that they made this, that they, you know, they did whatever it was that they did. But there is this sort of pattern. So how do you...
Okay.
You
know, if it's clearly one kid... Okay, I'll give you a more typical example, okay? So Arya comes home from school, right? And he just somehow got in trouble for beating up half his class, you know? And he's had a very hard day. And, of course, the half class that got beaten up had big brothers who came and beat him up, you know? And he comes home, and he's like, you know that there's that very critical juncture. You know, there's certain times in life, like, there are critical junctures, like, you know, where it's sort of like you have your hand on nuclear weapons that can destroy the world. That's what it's like when the kid gets off the bus. You know, they have a whole day's worth of restraint and frustration, which they have to let out of them, okay? So he comes home, and he's just bursting over with energy and pent-up frustration, and there's Shana Tova, just looking angelic, you know? And she needs a black eye, you know? Just, you know, she just does, you know? There's a sign that says, please give me a black... Yeah, all right. If you have a situation like that, so then you're having a bullying situation, okay? So this is not your typical... kid, you know, it's not mutual, it's not trying to work out conflict, not struggling with unfairness. Okay, then the problem is him. Now, sometimes you have to look then behind what's behind it. You know, because that usually is scapegoating, that's usually displacement. I mean, in the example I gave, it's the frustration and the the stress of a school day or something like that.
If you don't see it, let's assume that you don't see him give her the black eye. If you don't see it, but he still says, "Yes, I did hit her." He didn't say what precluded it, but he just says, "Yes, I did hit her." He admitted to what she claims, but you didn't actually see it.
Yeah. Now, okay, is he doing it because he wants to be punished? That happens sometimes. Unlikely. Probably then, okay, then you're addressing hitting. You're not addressing the sibling rivalry. You're addressing his aggressiveness. You know, you come to the next session on aggression, on anger in children, and we'll deal with that. It's not a sibling rivalry issue, in other words.
Yeah. The description that sibling rivalry is very helpful to learn how to resolve conflict. So what about an only child?
Okay, I alluded to that earlier. This is a common theme. Okay, it's a common theme. I'll tell you very quickly. I'll give you very quickly. There's a lot of research on the area called resilience, which is, it's an interesting thing. About 30 years ago, psychologists woke up and said, we've been studying why people are depressed. Let's study why people are strong. And they took people in situations where there should be problems who came out okay, and how did they come out okay. And very often, okay, 50 minutes, okay, thanks. What they came out with was that they find other people to fill those roles. In other words, someone who grows up without a father, and you need a father, whether you're a girl or a boy, find surrogate fathers, and those ones do well. The only children who learn these skills are the ones that learn them elsewhere. They learn them with cousins, they learn them with friends, they find other ways. It's almost like, you know how sometimes, if God forbid, part of the brain is damaged, another part of the brain that never handled that takes over? So we have a natural adaptive way of letting it happen. The only thing I would tell you is, if somebody does have a situation, today what would be more typical than an only child would be, let's say, as I said, a benzakun and basakun. In other words, if you have, you know, there's one kid who's 4 and the next one's 14, you know, I mean, those things happen, and the kid's not around siblings, those are kids that need to be around other kids their age and all that. They'll learn them in that arena. Yeah? I think there was somebody in the back was before you. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah. No, yeah, yeah, yeah. I would eventually guess. Yeah, what happens? What happens then? If two kids just really hate each other, you can't identify it as connected to any particular issue or other. There's just this contempt between them. My hunch is that usually there's something else behind. I don't think we're born with that, but let's say whatever. It reached that point. Then your position is you're entitled to feel anything you want, but there's a limit to what you can do. And you say, okay, fine. So then don't do things together, okay? So then we're going to make sure you're on the other ends of the house. Don't force or try to impose affection, because then you're guaranteed it's not going to happen. If their feelings are validated at one point, you know, then they don't... You know what happens is, if you challenge their feelings, then they have to feel it more to prove you're wrong. So paradoxically, it's like, you know, trying to get out of one of those little things with your fingers. You know, the more you try to get out, the tighter it gets. You know, it's paradoxical. You make them hate each other more. If you say, okay, you're entitled to your feelings, a free country, you know, but you're not entitled to punch each other, you know. So then, you know, stay away from each other. We won't share things, you know. You know, you have a room in the attic, you have a room in the basement, you know, etc. And then you'll see that that's the more likely than to get along. Yes, I'm sorry, I stopped you for you. Those are all the questions from this side of the room. Okay, yeah. Okay.
Oh,
good. You're already ahead of the game. Great. Okay.
So I just know that there are certain times where just one of them will just say, she's bothering me, and she's not doing anything. Like, I can't.
No, she is. She is. You know what she's doing?
She's
breathing. She's breathing. Vital signs are very annoying. I'm standing between two sisters. If they would have only stopped having vital signs, I would have had a much happier childhood. I guarantee. Okay. Uh-huh. Okay, now, suppose you have a neighbor, and your houses are very close to each other, and this neighbor likes purple window treatments. You can stand purple. What do you do?
Right, so how do you teach that to a kid who's not, like...
Sorry. If I had known earlier, I could have exchanged during the nursery. But... now it's beyond the, you know, we missed that period. You know, there's no deposits, no returns. We're stuck with her.
And therefore, you have to learn how to deal with it. And just know that, and it can really just
And then you know what's going to happen? Someday, this kid is going to find a wonderful young lady who's going to marry. And in every way, she's great. I mean, she's really wonderful. But she squeezes the toothpaste in the middle. Drives him crazy. He can't stand it. Toothpaste is supposed to be squeezed in the bottom, folded over. Right, honey? Isn't that the way? No, you know. Right? What's he going to do? And she's incorrigible. He sent her to toothpaste school, to toothpaste psychologist. Yeah, okay, go ahead. Oh, men have questions. Go ahead, yeah. No, it's gonna be, that, listen to something very Talmudic. And.
Both the kids, you know, have to go through a lot of things. And then the kids who are the most difficult to deal with,
Now again, okay, so again for the tape, okay, they're playing two toys, one kid, you know, Yankel has no interest in this toy whatsoever, but when Reuven comes along and takes the toy, now suddenly he wants it very badly and he wants to yank it away from him. Okay, now what do you want to teach him? I'm going to tell you again. We're going to fast forward. What do we want to teach him? The truth is, the bottom line, it is his toy. Again, we want to teach the kids that there is such a thing as ownership. These toys are everybody's. These toys are mine, yours, and you have a right. You absolutely have a right to take that toy. And I can't, because I want to teach him that ownership. But it's not very nice. I'm not impressed. So to say to him something like, you can do that. That's okay. But Daddy would be much happier. You'd be a much better person. Or you know what? If you can give your heart a push and, you know, and let him play with the toy, later I got an extra special lollipop for you. So I'm teaching him generosity. I'm teaching him sharing. I'm teaching him, you know, that's what I want. It's all lessons. You have to take the situation. I'll give you very simple. It's very simple. Take the situation, fast forward to adulthood. That's all they're doing in their childhood is, and that's going to be all the lectures you hear today. Everything they're doing, you know, childhood is a laboratory for adulthood. And experimenting and they're learning about things, skills they're going to need later on. That's all. Okay. One more male question. Okay, and I'll get to that. Oh, yeah. What?
The only male question?
There's a second male question. They process slower. So by the time...
It took them a while to, you know, I was using big words, so it took them a while. A little slower. You're ahead. Yeah.
I have a younger daughter who basically runs circles around both of my older and she likes to push the buttons. She realized that. And I'm just trying to figure out a way to figure out a way of trying to curb that a little bit. Because she goes around pushing the button. You know, she walks into the room, she says something to one, and all of a sudden I hear screaming.
Right, right, okay. I'll tell you a very surprising answer. You want to teach her not to push people's buttons? Practice with the older ones learning how not to let that stuff bother them.
Right.
You know? That's again, a life skill. Okay? I'm sure all of us in the workforce have had coworkers, bosses, customers who are as annoying as can be. Right? John Q. Public? Right? And you learn to tolerate it and you learn to handle it. So you teach them, you don't deny that she's annoying. She is very annoying. It's very hard. Let me teach you some skills. Let me teach you some tricks. And one of the things I tell my kids all the time, I tell them that right over here, you know, somewhere between the forehead and the brain is the delete button. And if you push that button, you can delete that person in your brain. It's there, I'm telling you. It's the same, it comes from the same science class about cars, the ventilation system causing sibling. I have my own science. Right over here, there's a delete button.
You're
deleting me. Okay. Thank you. Oh, great. Okay. Malin Bikadushin, Vay Maridin. Okay. Okay.